First Baptist Church of Redmond, January 30th, 2022, John chapter 2, Do Whatever He Tells You.
Please rise and join me in reading John 2:11. This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. You may be seated.
You already heard this in the last year. John Lafferty preached on this passage. And I decided to preach a different message, though it's on the same passage. And I'll be illustrating some things for you. But this is important because Christ is written about, and he John plainly says that it was his first miracle, first sign that he was the Messiah. I'll be dwelling on it later, but I want to talk about belief in miracles. An article about Americans' belief in miracles summarized the following statistics from recent surveys. 55% of Americans are certain that miracles happen. It's a 20% increase since 1991. I was surprised to read that because I would think we would be more skeptical. But 20% increase of 55% of Americans now, the majority of Americans now, are certain that miracles happen. 80% believe that miracles certainly or probably occur. 42% of Americans with no religious affiliation, they don't go to church, they don't practice faith, believe in miracles compared to 32% from 20 years ago. In other words, the strongest gains in openness to miracles were reported by those who attend services infrequently. 23% of respondents said they had witnessed a miraculous healing, and 16% said that they had received themselves a miraculous healing. And the last 75% of respondents said they had prayed to God to receive healing from an illness or injury, and nearly 85% had prayed for someone else's healing. The author of the article concluded that the increasing openness to miracles, quote, is not being driven by any one generation, but seems to be more of a cultural shift. There's still a profound interest in spiritual things. As Americans in general, we are not in this uniform march to secularism. This article surprised me because Americans are skeptical. I believe it when I see it. And my parents are from Missouri, and Missouri is the show me state. If you can't show me, I don't believe it. But the majority of Americans believe in miraculous event. I have another statistics to show you. Most evangelicals don't want short sermons. I thought that would elicit a laugh. There's been a trend in many churches across America, a drift towards more entertainment-driven services with a heavy emphasis on music and shorter sermons. I've been told by many people not to preach more than 20 minutes. But this is really what most believers want from their pastors and the churches. Well, you can see that I practice that. Ha ha. I have a pastor friend who's famous for, I don't go to his church, but they talk about it, 30, 45, an hour sermon. And he does it regularly. And they tease him, but you know what? They still go. So I'm going to practice my faith and preach at least 30 minutes. Because I think you want it. Yes? Todd's a believer. All right. John 2, 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. It's a famous passage, but I want to talk about the willingness to obey and the opportunity that we get when we look to believe. On the third day, it was the third day. John speaks somewhat in consecutive events. And it was the third day after Jesus had gained two more disciples, Philip and Nathanael. We probably assume that on the two preceding days, and perhaps even part of the third day, the Lord and his first six disciples, Andrew, John, Peter, James, Philip, and Nathanael, who was called Bartholomew, had been traveling afoot toward the place where the event recorded in John 2 occurred. Jesus mostly walked. There might have been other venues of transportation available, but the value of walking is you can spend time with other people. They can ask you questions. You have your life lived in front of them, and you have to get along. So he intentionally took advantage, and God had him born not today, but 2,000 years ago. And they didn't take a train. They didn't take a plane. They could have taken a cart. But I think the Bible presents Jesus as walking everywhere and spending time with others. Thus, on the third day, we find the little company present at Cana in Galilee. The mother of Jesus was also at the wedding. Mary was at the wedding. John is consistent in not mentioning the name of the lady who was present and who is probably his aunt, the sister of his mother, Salome. It is probable, we're guessing, but I agree with the assumption that Mary was not an invited guest, but rather assistant at the wedding. You've probably been able to, especially ladies, assist with the wedding. They generally ask for helpers, and it's typical for Mary as a woman, and we think that she was related to this bride or groom. But we're not sure. But I think she was not an invited guest, but helping with the wedding. You'll see how it plays out. And both Jesus and the disciples were invited to the wedding. Jesus was also invited together with his disciples. On his way to Cana, he stopped at Nazareth and received the invitation for himself and all who were with him, the seven of them. Another possibility is that Nathanael, who was from Cana, was authorized to extend invitations. We don't know how Jesus got invited, but there's two possibilities. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." If his mother Mary was a volunteer at the wedding, it might explain how it was that she knew about the wine about to give out. As the wedding proceeded, the wine began to run short. Jesus assisted when I think that Jesus was helping when they poured the last cup of the wine that they had. The language that the Bible was written in tends to favor that view because the wine was running out at the same time that Mary asked Jesus to help. We have no way of knowing what may be the reason for this, and it's better not to speculate. Let me tell you about a Jewish wedding. A Jewish wedding typically was celebrated for 7 days. It might have been shorter. It was not usually longer, but you can see that the wine began to run out on, I think it was, the day of the wedding, the first day. And they did not anticipate that the guests would drink so much. Now, in these embarrassing circumstances, when the wine failed, Mary comes to the rescue with the remark addressed to her son Jesus, they have no wine. They have no more. They've already run out. Of all those presents, no one knew better than Mary who Jesus actually was and what task had been assigned to him. That Mary expected a miracle. She was like most Americans who expect a miracle. Mary, too, expected a miracle. And Jesus said to her, "What business do you have with me, woman? My hour has not yet come." I want to read the passages on the side, John 19, 26 through 27. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciples whom he loved standing there, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." We talk differently in our culture, and woman, lady, was a way to address an adult woman, even your mother. One could almost translate it lady, for no disrespect of any kind was intended. It was the practice of the culture to address a woman that way. The biggest thing to notice is, my hour has not yet come. Clearly, it's indicating Christ's consciousness of the fact that he was accomplishing a task entrusted to him by the Father. Let me pause for a minute. There's some letters in our Bible, not in our Bible, that portray Jesus as always doing, quote-unquote, little tricks. It's said by the infancy gospel of Thomas. That's not in our Bible. That's not scripture. That he used to make little clay pigeons as a child, and boom, they would fly away. It's fanciful, it's mythical, and it's not right, because this is the first sign, the first miracle, the first thing pointing to the fact that he was special and unique that he ever did. It's clearly written in John 2:11, and the fact is, I believe my Bible. So, the first miracle Christ ever did was this event. Every detail had been definitely marked off in the eternal decree, so that each act stipulated the moment it would take place. When Jesus knew that this moment had arrived, he would act and not before. So, I'm sure that Jesus talked to his Father before he did the miracle. He did the sign. And he could exercise power at any time, but he never had done it before. He never had done it yet. Why? Because I think he began to draw disciples. And what good was it to have disciples if you're not a teacher? So he wanted to instruct them that he would be listened to, and how special was he? And the Father, I think, instructed Jesus to participate in this miracle. His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he tells you, do it." Mary immediately sensed that the reply of Jesus and his readiness to act at the proper time, in the spirit of complete submission and confident expectation, she said what it she said. What Jesus would order these attendants to do, perhaps, even might seem foolish, so they might not have been willing to do it. He was an invited guest. He wasn't working at the wedding. So she wanted to make sure first that her son would, if he asked anything from the servants, they would be expected to obey. Now there were 6 stone water pots standing there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 2 or 3 measures each. I want to read Mark 7:3. "And the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders." So, it was the custom in a Jewish household, an Orthodox household, to wash before you ate and drank. So, the custom was, they would take their robes, their outer garments, in public, and they would move the sleeves up. I can't move my sleeves up, but they had looser clothing than I have. They would expose it, their arms, and they would cause the water to be poured out, and they would raise their hands, showing that their hands would drip to their elbows before they would eat. Somewhere in the vicinity of the room where the feast was held, 6 stone water jars were standing. These were considerably larger than the one used by the Samaritan woman, the purpose of this larger jars is explained in Mark 7:3. A measure held the equivalent of about, or equivalent of, 8.5 gallons. Wow. You picture 1 gallon water pot, a 5 gallon jerry can of gas that was larger than that. 8.5 gallons. It would have been very heavy. So each jar was able to hold between 17 and 25 gallons of water. Water weighs by itself 8 pounds a gallon. So it would have been effort to fill the water pots. Accordingly, the 6 jars had a total capacity of between 100 and 150 gallons. Wow. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them up to the brim. Also, this detail of the story places the emphasis on the greatness of the gift Jesus was giving. Besides, the phrase with water is added to show that nothing was contained in the jars, and that nothing else could be added, for they were full to the very top. Some people explain this miracle as a trick. They claim that water was not what was in the jugs for use normally, but they were actually wine jugs. So they explain them the miracle as this. They were used for wine. They got dry, and Jesus poured the water in so that the dry wine would become liquid. And but you would know, and the wine would taste terrible. And it clearly says they were used for Jewish performance of washing. So they were water pots. They were called water pots. So there was no wine in the water pots because they were not used for this purpose. Did the helpers smile at each other when they carried all that water and cracked jokes about how this rabbi would give the guests a precious water as a new kind of wine? There must have been a lot of comments among the workers, but they did what Mary asked them to. And they said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." And they took it to him. Apparently, what these men dipped out was water, but it changed to wine immediately. However, John does not intend to convey the idea that only a small portion of the water was actually dipped out and changed into wine. On the contrary, the sense seems to be, keep on carrying wine. They dip it out again and again, and the jars hold between 100 and 150 gallons, all of which, having been dipped out, was immediately changed into wine. Now, when the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine, and he did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the groom over. Head waiter is a complex word, literally, to the superintendent of the room with 3 couches. Why is that a phrase? They normally had service at functions in a U-shaped sitting arrangement. They were tables, and they would normally be shorter tables than this one, and they would sit on the floor or on a cushion. I can picture them sitting on cushions or mats because they were wedding guests, and they were invited to the wedding. And normally, they would have extended the tables out and made the U-shape longer or bigger to accommodate all the guests. So the superintendent of the room with three couches means that it was a U-shape, and it was a table with seating areas that were not chairs, but mats. He was greatly surprised to see the swine, and especially he was surprised when he tasted it. The wine was such as never had tasted before, so excellent in quality. He said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when the guests are drunk," they drank too much, "then he serves the poorer wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. You saved the best for last." What was the source? Something happened. Many treatments of Jesus get bogged down in the discussion of the possibility of miracles. Properly speaking, that is a philosophical rather than a historical or a theological problem. All that needed to be noted is that ancient Christian, Jewish, and pagan sources all agreed Jesus did extraordinary things not explained by human means. While Jesus' disciples pointed to the Spirit of God as the source of his power, Jewish and pagan adversaries spoke about demonic, magical, or simple unexplained sources. It never occurred to any of the ancient arguments to claim that nothing ever happened. Something happened. From these words we learn that it was apparently a custom to hold and reserve the inferior wine until the tastes of the guests have been dulled. As a steward, the headmaster, therefore expressed astonishment that this bridegroom had reversed the usual order. It may have been intended as a compliment to the groom on the excellence of this wine. Daniel's going to come up as I explain the normal pattern for serving wine. And he said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when the guests are drunk, then he serves the poorer wine, but you have kept the good wine until now." I want to tell you about the alcohol Jesus used, and how unlikely it was that anyone could abuse the wine that Jesus made. Normally, when a Jew had to drink wine at a festival or a ceremony or anything, he would follow these steps. You would never, if you're a good Jew, drink straight, even grain alcohol. I think Jesus made wine. It says wine, and every place in the Bible infers that he would have drank alcohol, served alcohol. So it was a miracle. And I wanted to explain it. You poured first the wine into what was called a crater. That's the actual Greek word, crater. So, I'm describing the steps of making Passover wine. It was served at Jewish festivals. It was the wine that was expected to be used at a wedding feast. So this was the wine Jesus would make. And he made it in the pots. They didn't follow this process, but he made it, and it was expected to be able to be served. And he served it, and they said it was the best quality ever. So they would pour it into a crater cup, a crater pot. And you can see the ways of forms of the craters they would use. But they would dilute it with water. Thank you, you may be seated. They would dilute the wine they served for Passover, three parts water to one part alcohol. Even the Greek writers of the day say that even a pagan wouldn't drink great alcohol, aka a form of whiskey, without diluting it one to one with water. So they would never have 190 proof, but it would be diluted with water. And if it was Passover wine, what they would be expecting, it would be diluted three parts water to one part wine. It has been said that you would have to drink 11 cups of wine to have a 0.08 blood reading. So you could drink a lot of wine over a lot of time and not be inebriated. So I'm showing you this because I think Jesus made what they expected him to make. And they expected him to serve wine, and they dipped right out of the container. So they would have to drink a lot of wine. I said 11 glasses in an hour to fail a blood alcohol test in Washington State. So it's a lot of wine to ingest. Some people think that Jesus was helping them to sin, but Jesus did the miracle because he expected people to not sin and still do the miracle they would expect. And 11 glasses? No. This beginning of this, his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. You normally see a list of seven signs Jesus did in the Gospel of John: changing water into wine, healing the royal official's son, healing the paralytic in the pool, feeding over 5,000 with fish and loaves, walking on the water, healing a man born blind, and raising Lazarus from the dead. I think, however, this is the wrong list. I think there's only 6 events in John's gospel that are listed as signs. I don't include walking on the water because it's not said to be a sign. I know that's technical, but I think that there's only 6 signs that are mentioned. The turning of water into wine, the healing of the official's son, the healing of the lame man, the feeding of the multitude, the healing of the man born blind, and the raising of Lazarus. Okay? I think there's only 6. I know I'm being technical, but the rest of these are called signs. Walking on the water is a miracle, but it's not a sign. In chronological order, this was the first sign Jesus ever did. I think it's the first time he did a miracle. The term is used more often than John than by the other gospel writers. It indicates, sign indicates a miracle viewed as a proof. I have it in red. A proof of divine authority and majesty. He was showing the crowd and his disciples especially that they made a good choice by following him. It leads the attention of the spectator away from the deed itself to the divine doer, the man who did the miracle, often to the sign, a work of power in the physical realm, illustrates a principle that is operative in the spiritual realm, and that which takes place in the sphere of creation points away from itself to the sphere of redemption. He would be their Redeemer. He would be their Messiah. They would listen to him. They would trust him. They would believe the truth about him because he would be their sacrifice. Whether in any particular passage the term sign has the deep meaning, a physical illustration of a spiritual principle will have to be determined by the context. One thing, however, is certain: the sign points away from itself to the one who performed it. He's a special one. Who was the bridegroom? We do not know. Who was the bride? We are not told. They didn't make it into the story. In exactly what relation did Mary stand to the wedding pair? Was she perhaps the aunt of the bridegroom? It's silent. All the rest is shadow. And I want you to notice this painting because I'm going to mention Rembrandt. Rembrandt was the one who came up with the painting technique of the Dutch masters. He was Dutch, and he was especially the first one to develop the act of painting that included ruffles and made them look three-dimensional. What the Rembrandt did for art, John, under the Spirit's guidance, does for religion and faith, because he gives a deeper meaning to the fact that Jesus did signs. We already noticed that sign is used more often in John's gospel than the other gospel writers. Why? He emphasized that Jesus was God, and they should know, if they watch carefully, if they watch with believing eyes, that he was the Messiah. He was the Son of God. He was God himself. And his disciples believed in him. The faith of the disciples is emphasized, present even before this time. It was strengthened by what he did. The disciples, I think, were in the area where Jesus instructed the servants, the workers, the ones waiting on tables to say and give the miracle. And they were mystified why. Perhaps they thought that Jews would need extra cleaning, but when they dipped wine out of what they put in water, they were amazed. For us, Christ stands revealed here as the one who honors the bond of marriage. This does not surprise us, for according to John's description, John wrote Revelation 19:7, Christ himself is the bridegroom who, by means of his incarnation, work of redemption, and final manifestation, comes to his bride, the church. Let us be glad, rejoice, and give honor to him. For the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife has made herself ready. How then would he not honor that which is a symbol of his own relationship to his people, the church? Christ stands revealed also here as the one who bestows his gifts lavishly without stint. Surely one who supplies so abundantly in the physical realm will not be less generous in the spiritual realm. To his munificence there are no bounds, and his all his gifts are the very best. He helps us even in our embarrassments. Christ stands here revealed as the one whose infinite love is made effective by his equally infinite power. And Christ stands revealed here as the one who, accordingly, is the Son of God, full of grace and glory. I'm going to talk about a newspaper article. I had a hard time finding the original source because the Western Morning News, WMN, Western Morning News, is out of business. So they only have the articles in print online. But I wanted to tell you this story. The story published in a British newspaper began with the following sentence: heartfelt commiseration to Dorothy Naylor. I couldn't find her picture. Dorothy Naylor of Plymouth, England, whose recent day trip to Bridgewater was spoiled when her husband, Oliver, left her in the forefront of a garage and drove 17 miles before noticing his wife was not in the car. "I couldn't believe that he'd gone without me," Mrs. Naylor told the Western Morning News. I usually sit in the back because I can move around there more, but normally we talk to each other. So she had the unusual custom of sitting in the back seat of the car because there were days when they didn't need to wear a seatbelt, yes? I can remember as a child, my dad used to let me stand up with his arm around me in the car. And I lived to tell the story. He didn't get distracted enough to have any accidents. And he let me do that because I was so excited to go in the car with my dad. And I normally would make a trip to feed the ducks at a park. So he used to get a whole loaf of bread. I was extravagant. I would get a whole loaf of bread, and he would walk me over to the side of the lake. And he would be careful because ducks and geese can be violent. They could bite. But I was never bit because he was watching me. But I would throw all the loaves of bread into the ducks, and the casting your bread upon the water, I cast it on the water, and they would feed it. So I was excited. Anyway, that's an editorial remark. The couple, both in their 70s, had pulled in the garage to change a tire. It was leaking, and they changed the tire and replaced it with a good one. As Mr. Taylor drove off, and he didn't notice his wife's absence until he arrived in Bridgewater. After stopping in town, he asked his wife, where do you want to get out? Where do you want to eat? When she didn't answer, he turned around and discovered that he left her behind. The paper added that the couple had been married for 40 years. Wow. So, enough said about that. But I wanted to ask you, do you sometimes forget to take Christ on your trips? It's easy to not notice him. It's easy to neglect him. And because he's our Lord and Master, we assume he's watching us, he's with us, but he can be easily forgotten. And because he doesn't automatically judge us, automatically punish us, automatically, he loves us still, but we can easily neglect to bring him with us. I want to ask, if you neglect the Christ who bought you, do you neglect prayer? Do you neglect scripture reading? Do you neglect to remain in a constant state of awareness of your spiritual life? And do you go a whole day without thinking of your magnificent Savior?